All right, so I just wanted to start essentially by just following up on two really good questions that I received last time that we discussed. And so there were a few facts I didn't remember essentially off the top of my head. I just wanted to quickly follow up on this question of n-body simulations, which arose quite some interest. As Ramiro already sort of Googled at the end of last week's lectures, so for the Millennium simulation, we had there were essentially 10 billion particles, so 10 to the 10 particles. And I just did a quick literature search and just to get an idea of what sort of the current day state of the art is in terms of how many particles in n-body code can essentially evolve these days. And so I came across this paper that you can see here, which is from earlier this year. And I chose this one because it shows a nice compilation of different runs, current runs of different simulations here at the end, where essentially the authors compare their recent work to other current n-body cosmological simulations in this case. And essentially here they show the sort of number of particles. And so with a sort of fairly clever algorithm here, they were able to achieve an improvement by a factor of sort of roughly 1.5 or so with respect to the previous record holder. So now we are essentially at 4 trillion particles. So 4 and 10 to the 12 particles. So another improvement by more than two orders of magnitude with respect to the early Millennium simulation. So this is essentially state of the art, and really what people are fighting here with is essentially memory constraints of these huge computing clusters. So it's just very memory consuming to do these n-body simulations. And here they explain some tricks on how they could improve the memory usage and achieve this factor of 1.5 sort of improvement. And so I think they ran on something like 20,000 cores or so. So this is essentially the current, more or less the current state of the art, just to give you a brief idea. So these are the cosmological n-body simulations. If you go
Daniel, just a quick follow-up. So
sure.
Is working hard for a factor of 1.5 worth it?
Yeah, I was actually asking myself the same question. this paper is here entirely computationally motivated. So in terms of physics, I doubt that this represents a huge improvement over what has been done before.
Okay. Thanks.
But it just essentially indicates that it's very hard to do any better, at least right now. So this will essentially stay state of the art for a while, probably. So if you go essentially to other astrophysical systems, I also mentioned last time, so for example, globular clusters or so, which are of great interest now for LIGO and for all this population synthesis modeling, there these simulations are typically much smaller. So you get away with something like 10 to the 6 or maybe 10 to the 7 particles or so. So those are much, much smaller n-body simulations that also fit on much smaller clusters and so on. So the sort of the pushing the boundaries of n-body techniques is really on the cosmological front. Okay, and so the other question I wanted to follow up on was this question about the thermodynamic equilibrium. So I mentioned last time that essentially there's a special case of the Boltzmann equation that we discussed, where essentially you get the max value velocity distribution. And so the question here was really about where does why is the temperature essentially allowed to vary in space and time? And so I also didn't exactly recall the details, so I looked it up again. And so essentially the idea here is that in thermodynamic equilibrium, strictly speaking, it is true that sort of none of those variables would be allowed to vary with respect to time and space. So essentially, I just wrote down here a little appendix essentially to this. So if we think in terms of thermodynamic equilibrium, so the distribution function doesn't depend on time. Also, we don't allow for any gradient, so everything has to have sort of thermalized and relaxed into a steady state. We also neglect exterior forces, And so then the total derivative of the distribution function in phase space has to be zero, which means that the right hand side, the collision integral on the right hand side, also has to vanish. And then you can show that if you look at a collision integral just for two body interactions, you can exactly derive the Maxwellian distribution from that constraint. And in this case, it is true that since we obviously neglect time and spatial gradients, that all these quantities are not supposed to vary with respect to time and space. And so you get this Maxwellian distribution, the temperature is defined in this way, which you can easily derive if you just plug in this Maxwellian distribution back into the Boltzmann equation, back into the definition essentially up here of the specific internal energy density, and you'll find that it has to satisfy essentially this this constraint down here, or say this definition in a sense. Now you can relax this, and this is what I essentially meant above with this expression up here. You can relax this a little bit and say, well, what if we only have local thermodynamic equilibrium? So what if we allow for actually small gradients in the bulk fluid quantities, say in density, velocity, pressure, et cetera. So you can make the ansatz that the distribution function is something like a steady state plus some gradients, some perturbations on top. And if you require them to be small enough so that you can essentially linearize the Boltzmann equation for these perturbations, you can actually show that this sort of steady state F naught is now also given by a Maxwellian distribution. But here, actually, sort of all the physical quantities that appear in here now actually vary with respect to time and space because of those gradients that you allow on top of that sort of stationary solution. And so this can be derived rigorously, and you can have a look at I just noted down here two textbooks. So there's Biotor, a French textbook, Fluid Dynamics, Chapter 11. This is one of the very few fluid dynamics textbooks I know that actually has some treatment of kinetic theory here. And then also there's the classic Landau and Lifshitz Volume 10 part that actually describes this in quite some detail. So if you're sort of more interested in how to derive this, the details can be looked up there. Okay, that's essentially what I wanted to say, following up on some of those questions. So by the way, there were lots of really good questions last time, so please keep that up and ask a lot of questions. Okay, any more questions with respect to this? If not, then essentially let's move on. So last time we discussed the Euler equations. We derived essentially the Euler equations from the Boltzmann equation, from the moments of the first few moments of the Boltzmann equation. And I showed that essentially you can bring that those equations into a conservative form. And actually on the problem set, on the first problem set, you're going to show that the equations in conservative form are strongly hyperbolic, except for the case that you go into vacuum where the, sort of the pressure and therefore also the sound speed goes to zero. So this is why essentially all the fluid dynamic codes have to have some sort of atmosphere, some sort of non-vacuum state across the whole grid, because hyperbolicity would simply break down then. And so then essentially all the numerical schemes which are centered around strict hyperbolicity would fail. And so this is why we sort of, when we simulate, for example, a neutron star merger or some other systems where you have some exterior vacuum essentially around the object, you have to populate that with some sort of atmosphere. So you're going to show this on the first problem set. Now, I just wanted to sort of end this derivation of the Euler equations with just a few more remarks regarding the validity of the Euler equation, so of this continuous medium approximation. So this was essentially in the series of remarks that I started last time. So the first one was essentially on the conservation law of nature. The second one was on the equation of state. And now I just wanted to mention this last point before we move on. Just to summarize a few ideas concerning this continuous medium approximation, some of which I've mentioned already. I just wanted to make sure they are written down somewhere. And so the first thing that we obviously require is that we have a separation of scales, which is the following. So for the continuous medium approximation to make sense, obviously the mean free path of our fluid particles or gas particles has to be much, much smaller than sort of the finite or infinitesimal size of elements that we consider in phase space. So finite size of the medium elements that we describe. And then that obviously has to be much, much smaller than the characteristic size of the system we're interested in. And so essentially, as a consequence, the distribution function should not vary over scales of dx. And the number of particles within a given volume element in phase space should be large enough for this averaging to make sense, to be meaningful. So this is so the so-called collision regime. Again, if we are not in that sort of regime, then you would more likely resort to something like an n-body simulation, for example. So large enough for averaging to be meaningful. Okay, the second point is that the interparticle forces have to be strictly short range. So essentially the scale, length scale of the interparticle force should be much smaller than the fluid element size that we are considering. Otherwise, there would be energy momentum exchange with neighboring fluid elements. And this is exactly what we were neglecting when we were deriving the Euler equations. So in particular, there are sort of no long range forces. So for long range forces, this is what we denoted by this vector F. So we can account for those by adding this external force field. And so in particular, self-gravity, for example, cannot be obtained from the Boltzmann equation just by construction because we're neglecting long-range forces here. So we have to, so if we want to add self-gravity, so then we would have to specify an additional Poisson equation and then put the gravitational force as an external force field F into the Euler equations. And so this is how, for example, that would work. And so the third point is that, as I mentioned here, so peculiar motions, so the random motions of the individual fluid particles would lead to fluid particles traveling from one, essentially a volume dx to the next. And so there can be, through the exchange of particles through different fluid elements, there can be essentially transfer of energy and momentum, which is called diffusion. And so we were also neglecting this here. So peculiar motion close to the boundaries of fluid elements. Leads to diffusion, and that results in sort of frictional forces between fluid elements. And this is exactly what we were neglecting here. So remember, for example, this heat term, this heat flux term that we neglected in the derivation, and also we neglected in the pressure tensor, we neglected these non-diagonal elements, so these shear elements. And so in the Euler equations, none of this is accounted for. And this exactly brings me to our next chapter. If we wanted to include those, we simply have to extend the pressure tensor to sort of non-diagonal elements. And this is what leads to the Navier-Stokes equations. So we can relax some of these assumptions here of the Euler equations and get to some equations that are still computationally manageable in practice. And this also leads me to the concept of viscosity. So this is now exactly about relaxing this third point above. So when the interchange, essentially this diffusion of individual particles across fluid elements, cannot be neglected anymore, so that we have some sort of internal friction or viscosity in the fluid. And so the idea is, to modify the momentum flux density . So remember that we denoted this momentum flux density pi by pi, and now I just call it capital pi, where we are just adding an additional term. So this is called the viscous stress tensor. So in component form, one would write this as rho vi vj, where v again is the bulk velocity of the fluid. And then we have this isotropic pressure term, pressure times delta ij. And now we add another tensor here, sigma ij. And sometimes this combination of isotropic pressure term and sigma ij is referred to as the stress tensor. Where the sigma ij just covers the viscous part. Okay, and so there are some basic arguments now that you can make in order to specify sigma ij in a little more detail. So in general, we can make the following two assumptions about this stress tensor, or say about this viscous stress tensor. So if we want to describe this exchange of particles via diffusion through between individual fluid elements. This will lead essentially to frictional forces, right? And friction exists essentially when there are velocity differences. So when different fluid elements move at different bulk speeds. So one would expect the sigma tensor to depend on derivatives of the velocity, the bulk velocity field, right? And so if, say, these gradients are small, then, you know, we can assume that tensor to only depend on the first derivatives, and we can just throw away higher derivatives and so on. So let's make this first assumption that so friction requires differences in velocity. So sigma should be a function of velocity derivatives. Now, if the gradients are small, then only consider first order derivatives. And also that sigma is linear in those derivatives. And so the second point we can ask is that sigma be zero when the fluid rotates rigidly. And obviously when the bulk velocity is constant. And so with these two assumptions, you can show that, and this is, again, if you want to know more about this in classic Landau and Lifshitz, this is volume 5, I believe, fluid mechanics. I wrote down even the paragraph, I think it's chapter 15 or something. You can show that the general form of sigma ij should be, is already completely constrained by these two assumptions. So you have one term which describes the dynamic viscosity. So here we have these linear derivatives, and we just exchange indices to make it symmetric. And then this one is to make it trace-free. So here we have the summation over k. So this is the divergence of the velocity field, delta ij. And then we have what is called the bulk velocity. Again, a divergence term here. So let me just write down the names of these. So this is often called the shear viscosity coefficient. And this is the bulk viscosity coefficient. And so then also by basic considerations, you can show, again, I'd refer you to Landau and Lifshitz for that, because it's a rather long discussion that we cannot sort of follow here in detail. Those coefficients need to be independent of velocity. And also one can show sort of more rigorously that they ought to be greater equals zero for this to make sense. So by the way, I should also sometimes this is also referred to as dynamic viscosity coefficient. So what do these two coefficients actually mean? So this bulk velocity coefficient essentially parameterizes the energy transfer between internal motions of individual fluid elements, or say for individual fluid particles or gas particles, with the translational degrees of the bulk flow. So with the sort of macroscopic flow of the of the fluid. So this is essentially the transfer between microscopic and sort of macroscopic motions. So this is translational and internal motions. And so mostly, so for most cases, and especially for our cases in astrophysics, this is usually set to zero. Because, so for example, if you look at monoatomic gases, there are no internal degrees of freedom. And so there's no internal degrees of freedom that could couple to some sort of bulk flow of the fluid. And so this is why usually we set it to zero. It is also zero in particular for incompressible fluids. And so many fluids are incompressible. So maybe I should write this down. So this is managing for incompressible fluids. And by this, we mean fluids that are incompressible. So the density doesn't change, which means that partial rho with partial t needs to be zero. And this implies with the, so using the continuity equation, that the divergence of the velocity field ought to be zero. But if you look at this up here, this is just the divergence of the velocity field. So meaning that the second term in the sigma ij tensor will always vanish. No matter what you would like to describe up here. So for any incompressible fluid, that is zero, and sort of many fluids are actually practically, so for practical applications, incompressible. So this is why this sort of holds for a pretty large class of fluids you would potentially want to consider. So this is why also in, sort of in astrophysics, that doesn't really play a role. Unless you look at sort of molecular gases and different gas phases and so on and so forth, there can be couplings between rotational degrees of freedom or whatnot to bulk flow. But usually those are all not really of great interest. What is much more important, especially in the astrophysical context, are those shear terms, because they can arise actually in many, many astrophysical systems. And I'll comment on that in just a second. So as I said, this is the dynamic viscosity coefficient, and this is essentially momentum diffusion through shear motion. So faster fluid elements decelerate and slower elements accelerate. I'll comment on this a little bit more and explain sort of a little bit of the physics and the concepts behind this in just a minute. So if we essentially accept this form of our shear tensor, then if we make this replacement in the Euler equations, And by star, I mean this replacement up here, where we take the momentum flux density of the Euler equations and we just add this viscous stress tensor. Following the substitution, we end up with the Navier-Stokes equations. And so these are the following. So again, we have the continuity equation, which is unchanged. But now we need to make the substitutions in the momentum and energy equation. And so here in this divergence term, we now have the full momentum flux tensor. So this is the Eulerian part. And then here we have this viscous part. And then here again, the right-hand side is the same as before. And again, so this denotes the three different momentum spatial directions. And so the same substitution can be done in the energy equation, which is again very straightforward. So here we have this E plus P term Vj, and now we subtract the viscous term. And then the right-hand side is still the same. So where we just have the product between the velocity and the external force field. And so these are the Navier-Stokes equations. Now there will be, on the next problem set, there will be an exercise about this to sort of investigate in a little more detail what actually happens to these viscous forces, as essentially to these viscous stresses, how the energy is actually transferred between between kinetic energy and then dissipated into heat. As for the Euler equations, which is what you're going to do on the current problem set, you can derive independent evolution equations for the energy. So here we're looking at the total energy, which is kinetic plus internal energy. But you can also decouple this essentially, not completely decouple, but you can write down individual evolution equations for the internal energy and for the kinetic energy. And you can nicely show here that with these substitutions, essentially what happens is that energy is transferred from the kinetic energy and dissipated into heat, meaning that it's transferred into internal energy of the system. So these shear motions, these frictional forces generate heat. And so this is something you can easily see by just writing down these individual evolution equations. So this will be on the next problem set. And by the way, these are also very old. So in 18 have been looked at the first time by Navier in 1827, and Stokes actually derived them more formally a little bit later, but in the mid 19th century. Very old. Okay. Now let's again look at these viscous properties again. I just wanted to discuss a little bit more the sort of physics and astrophysics of introducing viscosity to a fluid. Now, first, one can realize that one can actually associate a characteristic timescale to viscous effects. So this is the viscous timescale. So for this, let's assume that we have a system where these viscous effects actually dominate the evolution. So then we can actually get rid of some of the other terms in the Navier-Stokes equations. So now let's assume we have a highly viscous fluid. And for simplicity, we can also say let's focus on an incompressible fluid, because as I mentioned, that approximation is valid actually for a large class of fluids, at least in practice. Because that also allows us to get rid of a few terms. So for simplicity, incompressible fluid, in this case, the bulk velocity term vanishes by construction, and then also the third term in the dynamical viscosity part also vanishes, so we just have this combination, Vj xi. So just remember, if I scroll up here, so here again we have a divergence term, and so these two terms, so this part and this part vanishes, and we're just left with this part here in front. Okay, and then let's look at the momentum equation in this case. So the momentum equation would be this one. And as I said, we assume that viscous effects dominate, so this viscous term on the right-hand side dominates. We only have this one term. And if we make a dimensional analysis of this, what we have on the left-hand side is essentially a velocity divided by time. So we can write this as some characteristic velocity over some characteristic time scale, which I denote by t nu. And then on the right-hand side, following again this dimensional analysis, we have a spatial derivative, which is the one over a characteristic length scale of the system, which I denote by L sys. And then the viscous tensor here has dimensions again of velocity over length scale. So again, we can write this as the characteristic fluid velocity over the characteristic length scale of the system. And so here we define this coefficient mu as eta over rho, and that's called the kinematic viscosity coefficient. So maybe I should just write down these other. Characteristic time and length scales of the system. And so from this expression here on the right hand side, if we solve for this characteristic time scale, we'll immediately see that this scales like this length scale of the system squared over the typical velocity, and this is the viscous time scale, so the typical time scale over which the system would evolve if we had just the system being dominated by viscous effects. Now this will play a role in a second. So we can now just try to estimate how important some of these effects would be. So what would be, for example, the viscous timescale of typical astrophysical systems, depending on what microphysical or macrophysical effect we actually assume for this shear viscosity. So let's try to estimate this a little bit. So because this will also allow us to essentially assess whether or not we should actually look at the Navier-Stokes equations, or rather just be happy with the Euler equations, depending on the system we look at. So one obvious source of such a shear viscosity or such a dynamical viscosity would be essentially molecular viscosity, so meaning the peculiar motions of individual fluid particles with respect to the bulk motion of the fluid. So let's try to estimate this using these length and timescale arguments, just dimension analysis. So peculiar motions with respect to the bulk motion. And so this kinematic viscosity coefficient, as you can see up here, has dimensions of essentially a length scale time a velocity. So we can write this down as something like a length scale. So this would be, in this case, the typical length scale for such peculiar motions is the mean free path of a particle. And then the typical velocity for this process would be the peculiar motion of the particle which we've always sort of denoted by U tilde above. So this is the characteristic or typical velocity of peculiar motions. And as we've discussed earlier, this is sort of related to the temperature. Now, if we estimate what the, so given essentially this ansatz, we can try and estimate what the sort of viscous timescale would be for a few different systems. So this would be of this type. And so let's say we look at, so I have two astrophysical, so I have sort of two sets of values for different astrophysical systems. So for example, one can look at an H1 cloud, which is a typical interstellar cloud. So this is neutral hydrogen, which is usually denoted by H1. Although it's not ionized, so it's neutral hydrogen. So this would be a typical interstellar gas cloud. And so you can estimate that this would be of the order of like 10 to the 12 years. So enormous time scale. So, you know, so I use here a length scale of 10 to the 19 centimeters. So the typical mean free path would be 10 to the 14 centimeters. And then the peculiar motion would be something on the order of 10 to the 4 centimeters per second. So if you plug in these values, you'll get this time scale. So it's an enormous time scale. The same thing essentially for smaller versions. So let's say we look at a protostellar disk. So this is essentially what is being created if you form a star. So when a gas cloud shrinks together, collapses onto itself to form a star, then you'll get an even larger timescale of 10 to the 14 years. So again, plugging in typical values for such a star-forming cloud. So And if you remember the age of the universe, this would be sort of something like 100 to 10 to the 4 times the age of the universe. So clearly, if we look at such systems, such clouds, for example, clearly we don't need to look at the Navier-Stokes equations. And essentially the Euler equations would be just fine. These viscous effects, at least from what as far as molecular viscosity is concerned, would not be of any relevance to sort of any reasonable time scale that we might be interested in. So we can completely neglect it for practical purposes. However, there may be other processes that give rise to viscosity, and that may actually turn out to be very important in astrophysical systems. And this is the concept of turbulent velocity. And so this is really everywhere in astrophysics. So this is essentially a sort of more macroscopic version. So rather than looking at the microscopic peculiar motions of individual fluid elements and the coupling of that to the bulk flow, you can have sort of small scale macroscopic flow patterns, so-called turbulent patterns, that couple to the bulk flow of the overall system that you're interested in. So here we're interested in how turbulent flows, so small scale macroscopic flows, couple to the bulk flow, so within bulk flow. And so typically in such turbulent situation, what you have is there's a sort of some random motions, turnover motions of eddies. So think of, for example, of a convection cells of sort of convective bubbles and usually they have some sort of characteristic size, let's say a characteristic size that we know, denote by LT for L turbulent, and some typical random, so some typical turbulent velocity VT. We can again write our viscosity coefficient as this length scale times velocity. So essentially we'll have these sort of, think of something like convective cells or something. So, you know, this would be sort of the typical turbulent velocity in such an eddy. And then you'd have something like the characteristic length scale LT of these eddies here. And depending on the kind of turbulence you're looking at, you can actually sort of put some numbers down for these two characteristic quantities. And that applies to sort of convection cells and stars, that applies to accretion disks. And so that's exactly the case I wanted to discuss, because it's fairly quick to point out, and it's an important concept that you'll see everywhere in astrophysics. So let's say we evaluate this for an accretion disk. So now let's think of a system where we have some central object, and then we have some accretion flow onto that central object. So there's some mass feeding rate onto that compact object, and that, or central object, and that can be a black hole, that can be a neutron star, but that can also be like in a protostellar disk, where you have the central star like the sun there, and then sort of you have this protostellar protoplanetary disk around it, and that accretes onto the young star. Or you can think of it as a supermassive black hole. So there's lots of astrophysical systems where essentially these basic ideas apply to. So some central object. And now what I essentially, and sort of in here you have, let's assume we have some turbulence here. I'll get back to this in a second. Let's assume that something creates turbulence in this accretion flow. And so we have some characteristic eddy size and some characteristic eddy velocity. Obviously, something like the height of the accretion disk would be sort of the characteristic length scale. So we could say that the characteristic length scale for turbulence in a turbulent disk is roughly the height of the disk. And we can also make an ansatz for the turbulent velocity that should scale roughly with the sound speed. So some constant alpha times the sound speed CS. So this is the sound speed. And this is some number, you know, somewhere in between 0 and 1. It's denoted like that. And the reason for this is essentially it cannot exceed the sound speed because if it would be supersonic turbulence, there will be shocks. So we'll discuss this later on. So the non-linearities of the hydrodynamic equations will then give rise to shocks, and in shocks you will dissipate kinetic energy into heat, and so you will do this until essentially your flow becomes subsonic, and so you can assume that in a steady state, that characteristic turbulent velocity has to be smaller or at most equal to the sound speed. And so this is why we can make this ansatz essentially. So then we can write down the kinematic viscosity coefficient in the following form, alpha CS times the height of the disk. And this alpha is called the alpha viscosity. Well, this is kind of a funny name, but it's actually a very important concept that goes back to Shakura and Sunyaev. In 1973. So I'll encourage you to take a look at their paper. That's an absolute foundational paper for accretion disk and all sorts of accretion astrophysics. They introduced this concept for the first time, essentially this parametrization of shear viscosity. And so now the question, as I mentioned, is sort of what would essentially generate turbulence in such accretion disks. And this is something that only became apparent in the 1990s.
Daniel?
Yes?
Could you again please explain what the reasoning was behind writing VT as alpha times CS, like how the sound speed comes in? I didn't quite follow that.
Oh, okay, sure. Yes, of course. Yeah. So the sound speed is a characteristic velocity of the hydrodynamic equations, right? So if you'll actually derive this on the first problem set. So if you look at the eigenvalues of the Euler equations, you'll have that the bulk velocity minus the sound speed, bulk velocity plus the sound speed, and the bulk velocity itself. These are the three eigenvalues of that strictly hyperbolic system. So the sound speed is a characteristic sort of velocity of these equations. And so any typical fluid motion will be sort of on the scale of the sound speed to some extent. Now, if let's assume that we had turbulent motions that sort of would that would be supersonic, so larger than the sound speed, in a stationary state. I was just making the argument that this is essentially not possible because if you have supersonic motions in a hydrodynamic system, that will lead to shock formation, so to discontinuous solutions to the Euler equation. So we'll show this actually later in the course. That's a fundamental property of sort of that comes in with the nonlinearity of the equations. And so if it was supersonic, it would create shocks. And in those shocks, kinetic energy is dissipated into heat. That's also something one can show, and we'll show this later on. So it would lose kinetic energy and would dissipate it into heat until the bulk flow velocity will be below the sound speed, at which time, you would not form any shocks anymore. So then you can keep essentially your typical characteristic velocity. So the main argument just being that essentially assume you start off with conditions that are supersonic, and you let the system relax. It will dissipate kinetic energy into heat until you're below the sound speed. So in a stationary situation, you can then assume that the typical turbulent velocity should be at most the sound speed or smaller. And so this is where this ansatz of alpha comes in. So this has to be some value that we don't know between 0 and 1. And the exact value of alpha will then depend on the exact physical mechanism that creates this turbulence. So that kind of stirs the system and creates turbulence in a stationary state. And this is essentially what I was mentioning now. So it was, for a long while, it was unknown essentially in astrophysics what actually creates turbulence in accretion disks. So observationally, you've always seen accretion flows, so X-ray binaries and things like that. So you've seen that there's actually a lot of matter falling onto central objects. And the question was always, from that you can derive typical accretion timescales. And those accretion timescales are so much shorter than essentially some of the timescales I was showing you earlier here with, if you just plug in something like a kinematic, something like a molecular viscosity, where the timescale would be much, much larger than the age of the universe. So how can you explain observationally that, you know, there's accretion flows with fairly short timescales, but all the macrophysical processes you can think of don't give rise to these timescales. And then essentially Shakura and Zunyaev said, okay, well, we simply don't know. We just parameterize this turbulence by some sort of parameter alpha. And then from the observed timescales, this tells us essentially what the microphysical kinematic viscosity would be. It doesn't tell us what the actual physical process is, but it at least gives us a number. And so this is also typically how like accretion disk simulations are done in pure hydrodynamics. You just assume some value for alpha and you look at, you know, how the accretion flow looks like. But the actual microphysical source for generating this turbulence only became known in the 90s, essentially, when it was realized by Balbus and Hawley, another seminal paper. So this is, let me just write this down here. They essentially realized that the magnetorotational instability, so that it's really magnetic fields that give rise to turbulence in accretion disks. So that's called the MRI, magnetorotational instability. And this is the seminal paper by Balbus and Hawley in 1991. So if you're sort of interested in that, have a look at that paper. And there's lots of, obviously, of follow-up papers and review papers since then. I can link more papers on that. They essentially realized that fluid sort of essentially, if you sort of threat the fluid with magnetic fields, then different fluid elements that rotate differentially, so have different rotation speeds, can actually couple to each other and exchange energy and momentum. And that is what stirs up essentially the small scale fluid motions. This is actually an instability, I shouldn't probably not go into too much detail, but the essence is really that so fluid elements couple via magnetic fields, and it's a runaway instability that leads to small scale turbulent motion, and that develops into a fully turbulent state eventually. And that is essentially what gives rise to those accretion rates. And so with some MHD simulations, one could then show in the 90s that essentially the accretion timescales were then matching the observed accretion timescales, and that sort of made a lot more sense then. And since then, essentially these magnetic effects are believed to to be the cause for turbulence in such systems.
Danielle, can I ask a sort of history question? So the
sure.
So the instability was known, you know, long before the 90s. So it was
that's right.
So it was basically the realization that it had a role in accretion disk that happened here?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes. So there's early papers from the, I think in 59 or 56 by Velikov. And so there's a Russian paper. I think they were the first ones to point out this instability in a, and they were thinking in terms of laboratory plasma physics, essentially, where they realized that if you have a fluid that is threaded by magnetic fields and you assume that it's not rigidly rotating but actually differentially rotating, then there's a coupling between these magnetic field lines between fluid elements, and that can lead to an instability. And that was not at all in the context of astrophysics, and that was only much later than it took up until the 90s until people realized that this process could actually play a role in astrophysics and could be realized in these accretion disks. And that was a big breakthrough then in the 1990s.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Interesting.
Daniel, sorry. I have a simple question. Yeah. And this comes from the fact that I don't know anything about accretion. So what you're telling us is that viscosity generates like some energy transfer from like the motion type energy into like heat. And that's why it falls faster, because it like has less energy, like on the orbit, say, like on the orbital type of motion.
So it is a transfer. So there's both. There's energy transfer, and there's a momentum transfer, right? So as you've seen in the Navier-Stokes equations up here, yeah, you see that there's a term in the energy equation, but also as I mentioned, you know, you can actually show that the some of that energy is dissipated into heat. So so there's a transfer between bulk kinetic energy into internal energy. But there's also a momentum transfer, as you can see here, in this term. And so essentially, what this means in the context of an accretion disk is that different fluid elements couple to each other, and what if they are differentially rotating? Say, if you're closer to the central object, say on this end, you're rotating faster than on this side, right? So this is rotating slower. So what actually happens is there's a coupling between the two via magnetic fields, and that leads to an opposing effect, meaning that the inner fluid element that couples to the outer one will be sort of slowed down, while this is forced to increase its speed, which means that this one is losing angular momentum, which means that it has to fall in. And the same for the other one. So essentially what it means is that the momentum transfer actually leads to accretion. So thanks for pointing this out. So it's not the energy transfer that leads to accretion, it's the momentum transfer. The energy transfer leads to the whole disk being heated up. There's dissipation into heat, and that generates then, you know, photons and some of the some of the things that we can actually observe. Exactly. Okay. Yeah, really good question. Thanks. Okay.
So, Daniel, do you know where this instability saturates?
That's a good question. So, this magnetorotational instability is essentially what people call a linear instability. So in the linear regime, it's sort of fairly well understood, and you can derive like a growth time scale and, you know, amplification time scale of the magnetic field and so on and so forth. But then at some point, this becomes completely, once these perturbations, these small scale turbulent motions become actually so strong that you're perturbing the equilibrium state to sort of the nonlinear regime, then it's fairly difficult to actually compute what how it would saturate and where it would saturate. And what you typically observe is, and maybe I should show you a plot next time, typically what you observe in these systems is that you actually amplify the magnetic field, and eventually it will saturate. And there's it's believed that essentially the saturation point is determined by equipartition between the small scale kinetic motions and the magnetic energy that is stored in these turbulent fluids, and so that there's an equipartition between kinetic energy and magnetic energy, and that is essentially what defines the saturation point. Now it also depends on other things. So this is essentially if you assume that there's no resistivity in the system. We'll actually discuss this when we discuss magnetohydrodynamics in just a second. So if you have explicit resistivity in the system, then you also downscale the magnetic field because you dissipate magnetic field. And then this is not entirely true anymore. So the actual saturation point is actually very hard to determine just by, you know, basic principles. And to my knowledge, it is not exactly known. You cannot write down an equation essentially or some relation that tells you exactly what the saturation point would be. This is something that you have to sort of numerically experiment with in the nonlinear regime from case to case. Does that roughly answer your question?
Sure.
Yeah, thanks. That's another good point. And that's a perfect segue to our next topic, which is magnetohydrodynamics. So I wanted to briefly also introduce the equations of magnetohydrodynamics. And again, also here show, so basically we've seen that the Euler equations and with this modification of the momentum flux tensor, also the Navier-Stokes equations can be written in conservative form. So we can apply conservative numerical schemes to evolve them. And so this is something we'll discuss next week. Well, actually, in a few weeks from now, we'll start with a different starting point next week. But anyways, what I'm going to show now is that also if you include other effects like magnetic fields, then even then you can still rewrite your evolution equations in conservative form. And so you can apply the exact same numerical techniques to evolve this even more complicated system. So unless there are more questions on viscosity for now. So if not, then it turns out that actually in astrophysics, we deal with ionized media all the time. So far we've assumed that essentially we have a neutral gas, neutral gas particles, but really what we are looking at in astrophysics most often is an ionized medium or plasma, where that can conduct electric currents. So we have free charges everywhere. And so we expect this to interact with electromagnetic fields. And so essentially the simplest description of a plasma under the influence of electric and magnetic fields, the simplest possible approximation you can do is what we call magnetohydrodynamics. So this description actually breaks down to some extent and becomes much more complicated. So then again, you have to resort to more kinetical gas theory and things like that. Once you go to other plasmas, such as like in fusion reactors there are some applications, obviously, where the following assumptions that I'll list in a second will actually break down. But for many astrophysical systems, this most simple approximation of magnetohydrodynamics is actually fairly well satisfied. Simplest possible approximation is or MHD. And so this is really defined by the following four assumptions. So let me explicitly write them down. The first assumption is that okay, this is an obvious one, namely that we can treat the plasma as a continuous medium in the sense of the Navier-Stokes or Euler equations in the absence of electric and magnetic fields. So if it was, if we would let it to recombine, essentially cool it down and recombine all particles, so all electrons and positrons, and form neutral atoms, we would be back to Euler and Navier-Stokes. That is essentially the idea. So as continuous medium described, Navier-Stokes, in absence of electromagnetic fields. And this in particular, again, brings in all this sort of statistical description and so on and so forth. And in particular, also this collision regime that we need to sort of for this to make sense. Now, the second assumption is that we have enough charges everywhere, so that positive and negative charges are globally, so locally and globally balanced at all times. Locally and globally balanced at all times. So in particular, this means that we don't have any long range forces due to electromagnetic interactions between individual particles, because you know, you essentially screen, so far away, you essentially screen all those charges from a different fluid element, simply because you always locally balance charges. And so as I mentioned earlier, this was one of the assumptions, right, of following the Boltzmann equation and then going into the moment equations, and that we actually discard all the long range forces. And so this is what we need to assume here to make it work. So the fluid elements are effectively neutral. Now, the third assumption is a little more subtle. And it's the following, so that we assume that the electrons, so the lighter particles essentially are always in statistical equilibrium with the heavier particles, with ions, or sort of this could be protons or sort of more heavier ions, so that they have the same temperature, so that we don't have different temperatures for different species of charges. For different species of particles. So we have to assume that those are in statistical equilibrium. With ions, so same temperature. And finally, the fourth assumption that defines this magnetohydrodynamics approach is the following, that the interparticle collisions are frequent enough for essentially the electromagnetic forces to be shared among all fluid particles. So among the charged particles, but also among the possibly neutral particles that we could have in the fluid, so that electric and magnetic forces essentially always instantaneously act on all types of particles that we may have in the fluid. Because otherwise we would have to discriminate between different types of particles and would have to write down different sort of external forces through these fields on each individual type of particle. So instantaneously transferred from electrons, say, to ions and neutral particles. So if there are any present. So this depends on the ionization states of the atoms or molecules that we have. And that again depends on the temperature and so on and so forth. So in general, we can always have different species around neutral and non-neutral particles. But then there's this question of actually, if we assume that everything is locally and globally charge balanced, how come that actually currents can flow? Because for currents to flow, we need that sort of different charges, so positively, negatively charged charges have to be able to move at different speeds. Otherwise, there is no currents. So at the same velocity. Well, but it turns out, and we'll show this actually below in just a few moments, that the relative drift velocity between ions and electrons is actually, if you compute it on a dimensional analysis, is actually so small that it's much, much smaller than any typical sort of bulk velocity of the fluid. So you can actually always neglect that drift velocity and pretend as if electrons and ions would always move at the same velocity. And so this is how the assumption then, so this assumption two essentially is sort of consistent with that notion. Okay, so small. That it can be neglected. So at least on the order, sort of on the level of these macroscopic equations. So we'll actually discuss this below a little more, just to already note this upfront here. Okay, what do we have to do now? We have to couple essentially Maxwell's equations with the Euler equations. Okay, so how do we do this? So you may all remember the Maxwell equations. So it's 4 pi times the charge density Q. Then we have the divergence constraint on the magnetic field, so no magnetic monopoles, divergence of B equals 0. And then we have these two equations. So I'm using Gauss units here, by the way, in case you wonder. So CGS units, which is very common in astrophysics, unfortunately, but that's for historical reasons. So these are the Maxwell equations, and we can actually make the first approximation here on the fourth equation. Namely, we can essentially set this. We can discard this term here, which is very small for the following reason. And this is essentially what one could call the plasma approximation. So from the third equation, we can again, doing dimensional analysis and say, okay, the curl of E here is dimensionally something like the typical field strength divided by the typical length scale L. And then on the right-hand side, we have the typical magnetic field strength divided by the speed of light C times some time typical time scale T system. And then we can also define again the characteristic plasma velocity, which is the length scale over a characteristic time scale of the process that we are interested in. And so we can write this term down here dimensionally as, again, the field strength over C times the time scale, characteristic time scale. Now we make use of this, of the third equation, to write this as the magnetic field strength times the length scale over the speed of light squared times the time scale squared. And so we can just write this as the typical velocity squared over the speed of light squared. And then dimensionally, again, we have the curl of B here. And so as long as we assume a non-relativistic plasma, this would be much, much smaller than the curl of B, which is the term here on the left-hand side. So this essentially shows that this term would be negligible with respect to this curl of B term. And so this is our first, essentially, so for now we assume non-relativistic plasmas. Okay, so this is the first approximation we'll make. And so now let me just, on a similar note, just estimate the drift velocity. So if we then use equation 4, we can estimate, again, the left-hand side by just making this dimensional argument as above. So this is equation 4. And then we have on the right-hand side, since we neglect the time derivative of the electric field term, we just have the current, electric current, which is just the charge density times the drift velocity of the current. And just by plugging in typical values, one can see that so this would be 10 to the minus 12 centimeters per second, for example, for a typical solar plasma in the convection zone. And sort of even if you go to the interstellar medium, it is still fairly small, centimeters per second, 10 to the minus 2 centimeters per second. And so this needs to be compared to turbulent velocities. As discussed earlier, which are typically, so for typical astrophysical systems, that is usually on the order of at least a kilometer per second or so. These are typical turbulent velocities, either in convection zones or also in accretion disks. And so these drift velocities really don't play a huge role. And at least on the order, on the level of the equations, we can essentially assume that locally the fluid elements are all neutral. Okay, maybe I should stop here and write down the actual MHD equations next time. So this is essentially what I wanted to say regarding the Maxwell's equations. And so we'll now couple them with the Euler equations to obtain the MHD equations. And that construction, I think I'll discuss next time, because it would take me at least 10 more minutes to get there. And so maybe now is a good time to stop and maybe see if anyone has questions so far.
Daniel, did you say that you're going to neglect the charge density term in Gauss's law?
No, so the charge density will still be there. It is just to essentially motivate the assumption that locally the plasma will be neutral. So we will still have this, so we will have still this term here on the right-hand side. So we will not neglect that term. So like here.
No, the current you want to keep. I was thinking of the charge density term in equation one.
Oh, and no, that will remain there. But we will actually not explicitly make use of it, as far as I remember. Yeah.
Okay, but if you're assuming that the fluid elements are neutral, then does the charge density play a role in any?
No, it doesn't. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Any more questions?
Maybe I have one more question. So yeah. In the beginning, you mentioned basically the constraints on the equations or on the approach that we use. And the second one was that we exclude the long-range forces, which we also have seen now. But then you gave, for instance, an example where we did the dimensional analysis of a cloud of neutral hydrogen. So if you have neutral hydrogen, you would, for instance, not have any electromagnetic forces there. And the gravitational part would be the dominant one. So I was wondering how this can be taken care of then in this formalism.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, thanks for the question. Maybe I should scroll up here. So essentially what you would have to do is you'd have to solve an additional Poisson equation. So I was mentioning this, so that the gravitational potential, and then on the right hand side you have, can you see this on my screen? Yes. So you'd have the rest mass density essentially on the right hand side that sources the gravitational field, and then in here you would then sort of put the gradient of the gravitational field as the external gravitational force into the Euler equation, and so this is how you would account for gravity in the system.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Any final questions? Yeah, if not, then enjoy the rest of your evening and see you all on Thursday. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. Goodbye.